This is the Geek Dads, the podcast of GeekDad.com on the Wired Blog Network. This is episode 107, and anyone who says otherwise is evil and bad and wrong. Hello again, everyone. You found it. We are back. This is the Geek Dads, episode number 107. I am Ken Denmead, editor and publisher of GeekDad.com. We're well past the Happy New Year's. This is just, you know, I would consider this our first sort of normal podcast of the year now. And joining me, thankfully, two out of three of the other editors of GeekDad.com, Mr. Matt Blum, managing editor. Hi, Matt. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. You know, things are hectic, but good.
I mean, they haven't settled down into a nice rhythm post-holidays.
Well, I mean, well, good things keep happening, you know, things that require time investment. So.
Okay, yes. Good things are good. We like good things. And I'm right there with you on that. This little things are popping up and, you know, they're going to be exciting. So we'll see. Right next to him on my virtual screen is, of course, our senior editor, Jonathan Liu. How you doing, Jonathan?
Good. I'm doing good.
Excellent. You said you guys had snow this week.
Yeah, we've had some snow in Portland. Nothing's stuck. I think, you know, we maybe woke up one day with a thin layer of white on the ground, and that immediately melted. And, you know, snow in Portland's kind of a very wet, mushy thing.
Yeah. I did have to get out a drywall knife to get the frost off of my windshield this morning. It has been cold enough in the last week. It's been in the like low 30s overnight or cooler. There were supposedly a couple of places up in Napa Valley that got down into the single digits.
Wow.
Which is hardcore for
that can't be good for the grapes.
No. Actually, grapes are, I don't think there are any growing right now. We are before the grow season.
This is true. But, there's always ice wine, you know.
That's true. That's absolutely. Yeah, we're past the late harvest, and now, if anything, it's ice wine. So cool. So, you know, it's not been a huge last couple of weeks since our previous podcast, but there are a few things sort of floating around in the geekosphere that we should probably talk about, not the least of which is tomorrow, or by the time you hear this, today or yesterday or last week's SOPA PIPA blackout protest day. And I will say that no, Geek Dad is not blacking itself out, not because we particularly support SOPA and PIPA, and I would think if you would pull all of the Geek Dad contributors, we'd probably all say that we are, you know, well and truly against what those bills stand for in terms of, or what they were trying to do to reach their ends. But you know, we don't have that much control over the website, so other than not posting anything, we wouldn't be able to do much. And realistically, whether or not you might think this is a cop-out, we do try to keep Geek Dad as apolitical as possible in terms of what we do post and how we act with it. There are a couple of issues that are like family, parenting, you know, common sense, quote, common sense, unquote, issues that we sort of take stands on. But besides that, you know, we're trying to be inclusive of parents, of geeky parents, as much as we can. And so we're kind of careful about that. I hope that doesn't sound like too much of a cop-out, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think if we had more control over it, I might have, you know, advocated a little more to do something, just because we, you know, it is... There does seem to be a fair bit of unanimity on the side of being against it. I mean, especially now that there's been so much posted on the various internet sites that a lot of congressmen on both sides of the aisle have come out. You know,
well, at least within our rather large, you know, bubble that we live in terms of being geeks and technically connected and understand what's going on. And yes, absolutely. unfortunately, it seems like, you know, a lot of the people that were behind these bills are not, you know, either.
Well, unfortunately, I mean, a lot of the language has been scaled back. Like, yeah, they scaled back SOPA a great deal, so that, like, the stuff about DNS entries has been taken out.
Right.
So at least that's some of the worst stuff is gone. Although, but enough of it's still there that it's certainly still there.
Right. And they did announce that they're going to be going back into markup on it in February. So
yeah,
it will come back. It's something is going to probably get to a vote, you know. And realistically, the DNS stuff, while troubling because it's such a mechanical difficulty, I can almost see that it would not have ever really been implemented, at least to its darkest, fullest extent, even if something did pass. My bigger concern is how these laws, you know, this and, you know, to an extent the DMCA even and some of the other stuff, sort of, you know, at least from my point of view, circumvent appropriate due process and make it way too easy for people to use unsubstantiated claims to affect real harm to other people.
Right. Yeah, essentially, if it had gone through as written, if you linked to a site, any, you know, some site you had no control over, you would first have to make sure, if you wanted to be in full compliance with the law and didn't want to, you know, accidentally get on the wrong side of it, that website didn't have anything published on it really ever that was infringing on anybody's copyright.
Right.
Which is impossible. I mean, there's no way you would never be able to link to any other website. It's not any other website that was more than like 3 pages big. But seriously, how could you ever possibly do that?
You can't link to GeekTed.
Right. So essentially, you link to anybody, and you're suddenly, you know, you get to, you open yourself up to being taken down.
Right.
But, and that's ridiculous. You know, we would have had to literally go through and scrub all of our old posts of anything that linked to anything that might be construed as infringing on copyright, which is, I'm sure, a lot.
You know what? Quite a significant number of people, better informed than myself, at least, have written a lot of very good words on this. And if you don't know the whole story yet, I totally encourage folks to go out and learn more of the story.
Go to Boing Boing and read Cory Doctorow's stuff on it. He's got some of the
absolutely
best.
Absolutely. So in any case, I am privy to the fact that there will be some nod towards the blackout on Wired tomorrow. It won't be an actual blackout because, of course, being a large part of a large corporation, they can't, you know, not serve up the ads that they have to serve to actually make the money to run their website. But they are going to do something kind of cool that I understand with the presentation of the front page that will at least make a good statement about this. So I urge folks to come take a look at that tomorrow.
I'm glad to hear that. I saw that there was a post on WebMonkey that was on the front page of Wired this morning that was talking about how to, if you want to black out your website, how to do it so that you don't hurt yourself in your Google standings.
Right.
Which I thought was very smart because a lot of people, you know, just saying, oh, you know, just redirect to this page. And it's like, well, you don't really want to do that because then Google's going to change your indexing of your site. And all. And I like that Google's going to do something at least there. I mean, I understand they're not blacking it out, but they're going to put like they're going to change one of the O's to a stop sign, I think, and put like stop SOPA on or something like that.
Yeah.
They're going to do something on their homepage. So that's not nothing. I mean, it is, you know, one of the most popular websites, you know, in the world. So.
Yeah. So if they can get their word out, you know, that's going to have a lot more resonance than the rather misguided statements of certain congressmen who are talking out of their posteriors. So
Well, I thought it was interesting that, and after Reddit did a whole lot of coverage and people really lobbying, like Representative Paul Ryan, you know, who's fairly conservative and had been a big supporter of it, he switched to the other side.
I actually want to double check that, because I swear I read something where, no, he had not technically been pro. He just really hadn't said much about it at all.
That could be.
So in that case, it was, you know, it, it, it was a little bit, it wasn't so much that he was flip-flopping or that he was being pressured, it was that he really hadn't cared at any point, and when it started becoming an issue, then then he went, oh yeah, wait a minute, by the way. So, you know, can't go all the way on that, but I find it really interesting that, you know, a site like Reddit was able to pull something like that off, which is pretty cool.
And apparently he did. Apparently he did have a pro stance. It didn't say it wasn't. I was just looking at.
Okay, double check that. Yeah.
Yeah. So he did have a pro stance. He wasn't like, you know, one of the most vocal, but he did. He was on the record as supporting.
Okay. Well then, there we go. So anyway, folks, pay attention and speak out. You know, the sort of the irony of this is that it seems like this has galvanized the online community very strongly. I mean, unlike, except for a few issues over the last few years that we've seen it done before. And so people are talking out and they're getting the word to their representatives as well as they can. You know, the emails are set up and all this stuff. But I think it's so funny that the actual people that proposed this bill and the people that you heard arguing for it in those committees that didn't understand any of the technical issues around this and just thought, you know, somebody told me that people are losing jobs because of this stuff, so we better stop it, and all your technical complaints are just silliness. You realize that we're using the tools that these people don't understand and don't listen to try and convince them of something. And I wonder, you know, how much of that really gets through, or, you know, it probably doesn't even matter. In a cynical world, you'd say they're not going to listen anyway because they're, you know, beholden to the people that are spending money to bend their ear more than anybody else.
Right at the motion here.
Yeah. All right. Enough of that. That lively and interesting topic. So Matt, you had brought up in planning that about the issue of Google including personalized Google Plus results in searches.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of a strange thing that they just sort of introduced. I mean, it was kind of out of the blue. I don't think there had been a lot of lead up to it. They just sort of said we're going to be doing this starting tomorrow, I think, and then there it was. And I don't know. I haven't seen anybody say that they actually like it. So far, I've seen only people saying, "How do I turn this off?"
Yeah, and it is there to turn it off fairly easily.
It is, but the question is, did anybody actually want this? I don't know. It just seemed like kind of a really strange thing for them to do. And a lot of people, you know, are criticizing them because it's kind of mixing the private and the public results. And, you know, I don't know if Shelley thinks it's necessarily an invasion of privacy in any way that I can see, but it's a really kind of a.
Well, in one sense, it is, I think, a logical extension of the idea of personalized search, in that if you're searching on a topic and people that are in your social circles, at least according to Google Plus specifically, have said something about that issue, then it does make some sense that you might want to see those results first.
Yeah, that's true. You might want to, but I would say, you know, make people request that.
Yeah, the opt-in versus opt-out argument is always, you know, that's always going to be a touchy issue. Yeah. You know, the other half, of course, a lot of people are raising an alarm because it seems like some sort of pseudo-monopolistic behavior because, well, they're not doing it with Facebook results and they're not doing it with Twitter results.
That's true. On the other hand, when they used to have a search, the social media search as part of their regular things, they got in trouble with Twitter and had to drop it.
Well, yeah. I mean, they were supposed to pay for it, too. You have to pay for the Twitter hose, the what do they call it, the Twitter fire hose.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, I think that was kind of silly of Twitter to be too strict about that, because seriously, if it's driving more traffic to Twitter, why be too strict about making them pay for it?
Well, because they have a cost model of selling the fire hose to people. So that can be part of it. It's, but yeah, no. It this is going to be interesting. We'll see how long it lasts. But, you know, the flip side is now all this stuff starts showing up and people actually get, you know, normal people will still see some Google Plus results in their, you know, in their results. And it may be a leveler that gets, you know, Google Plus to that next step. Now, you know, I am so confused about where Google Plus is right now because, you know, you heard about it doing well right at the start, and then people were sort of talking like, okay, now it's leveling off or it's you know, falling back and it's going to go away. But realistically, all of the savvy tech people that I pay attention to are still there and using it pretty strongly. It seems like it's getting more penetration. So, and this kind of move could be just another huge step to making it a three-way race or a two-way race with Facebook, and then Twitter's doing, you know, is sort of a half competitor to each of them.
Right. But I mean, Google was already under investigation for antitrust, so it may not have been the wisest thing to have poked the bear a little bit.
You know, well, I don't know. On the other hand, when you're that big, and you know the bar gets lowered for what, you know, opportunistic behavior is, but it's always hard to know where that bar is.
Sure.
They make enough money that they might as well, you know, they probably get into the mindset that, you know what, it's better to beg forgiveness than ask permission. Unfortunately, or yeah, so.
When it comes to the government, that isn't always the case. But yeah, I see your point.
Yeah. So it's not so much surprising to me that they did it. It's just, you know, will it be effective, and what will the consequences be?
Right. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
Jonathan, did you have any geeky news stuff that you wanted to bring up that didn't make it on our list?
No, not much. I hadn't really kept up on the Google personalized search stuff, so that's something that I don't really use Google Plus a whole lot, and I'm not using Facebook much either. Mostly I use Twitter these days, but I ended up with I don't have a very good way of sorting out my contacts, you know, and I like the idea of the circles in Google Plus, but I don't think I ever made really good use of those. So what happens is, you know, Twitter is like, you know, there's too many people that I'm following for me to actually follow them.
Yeah.
You know, so I try to check up on my list every so often, but it's turned into something where I think I have too much noise in all of my feeds to really try to keep up with things. And that's one of the things where, like, you know, the amount of effort it would take me to go through and clean up any of those three accounts just seems like it's too high. So
yeah,
I end up kind of ignoring a lot of it.
Totally. I mean, my point of view is any of those to me is I'm paying attention to it right now. So what is the interaction that I'm having right now? On Twitter, I'm running about 4,300 followers right now. I only follow about 500 because I find any more than that, even when I'm just looking at the feed, it will go by too quickly. And I actually want to be able to pay attention to some of it. And then, you know, if anyone wants to talk to me, they, you know, I get a mention and we'll have a conversation, or, you know, or DMs. But I look at it as those are my filters. Those are my, you know, the three levels of interaction. And more than that, I've got email for actually communicating with people.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I get, you know, I pay attention to DMs and public replies, and anything else tends to get lost, you know. But even emails at this point, you know, with all the PR lists that I'm on, it's like, sorting through all of that to get to the things I actually want to read.
Oh yeah.
You know, tends to get overwhelming. I decided, you know, one of my resolutions for this year, I said, I want to spend more time actually reading books than reading about books.
Hmm.
You know, there was one company, I forget which book it was. They sent me a book and they sent me a folder full of
press materials.
Press materials. I mean, like photocopied articles from newspapers and magazines and their own PR stuff about this book. You know, and for me, like, I don't want to read a whole bunch of other reviews of a book before I read the book. Right?
Yeah.
You know, give me your one shot, you know, here, tell me why I should read your book, and then leave it at that. Like, don't give me, you know, 80 pages to read before I read your book, because then I'm just going to set it aside and say, nah, I'll read something else.
Yeah, sounds about right. I know. I mean, you know, my daily routine starts with getting up at you know, 5 something in the morning, and the first thing I do is I've popped out the iPad, and I am clearing the 15 to 20 emails in my personal account and the 15 to 20 emails that come to the account that gets all the PR. And that's that's the first thing I have to do, just to feel like I'm on top of the world. And it gets and you know, especially with the PR emails, it's one email in 30 or 40 that actually is worth following up on in some way.
Right.
So, oh, boo-hoo on us.
Yeah, I know. First world problem. Yeah.
Big time. All right, last bit of sort of news discussion that I had tossed in was not that any of us got to go, but at least we probably saw a little bit from afar, was that CES was in the last week. The Consumer Electronics Show. A million square feet of gadgety goodness out in Las Vegas. And, you know, there wasn't a lot that really stood out for me in all of the coverage. You know, the most interesting things, first of all, was LG Displays showing off the 55-inch OLED television, which looks like it will actually be a production item and go on sale sometime this year. And for all intents and purposes, that is a holy Toledo piece of kit. Tiny, as Benjamin is mentioning in the chat room, 1 millimeter bezel, a 4 millimeter thick panel. It's like the thickness of an iPad for a full 55-inch television. It sits on a stand, and it's got sort of a all of the guts are in. It's almost like a CPU box separate from the display, but that's kind of elegant. And the colors and the blacks are just supposed to be mind-bogglingly good. And now, you know, we have about a 10-year-old TV. It's an old DLP rear projection. And, you know, I've been toying with the idea of getting a new TV soon, but that's going to be too much. That's going to be like $6,000 out of the gate. And it's no, can't go there. But, you know, maybe waiting another year and a half to see where they settle down.
When the new cool stuff comes out, everything else drops in price.
That too. Yeah. They keep walking past the 70 and 80 inch TVs in Costco. Holy! I don't even know if I could fit that in our room.
I was gonna say, how does your wife feel about that?
She'd drool over it too. Luckily, in my family, we are a media consumption machine, so she would love it too. But
then there's the replicator.
The replicator.
Yeah, they won a bunch of a bunch of awards. Sounds like
they did.
Yes,
I heard that. Yeah,
this is one. I mean, this is one where I'm almost thinking about arguing that we could spend some Geek Dad money on. You know, how awesome would it be to have a replicator at the Maker Faire booth?
At Maker Faire,
to make some things and give them away at the booth. That could be cool.
The only problem would be keeping the supply of plastic
stuff
from running out, because everybody would want to use it.
Right. Well, we just keep running over to Bree's booth and going, Bree, come on, we need more stuff. Come on, man. Because he's actually going to be a dad by that point, too. So
that's right.
We can give him the old, you know, nudge. looks like an amazing machine. Really, really cool. Between that, and I was looking at one of our Smithsonian or something that we got this month. There's actually, you know, they've got all sorts of really interesting ads in the back of those magazines, sort of like, you know, National Geo has them too. And these interesting companies putting out really interesting products that you don't sort of ever pay attention to. Somebody advertising basically a CNC plasma cutter.
Okay.
So basically you can cut out really awesome patterns from sheet metal, from like, you know, heavy sheet metal.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, oh, that would be cool to do something with. Probably only $20,000.
Yeah, that's not all.
And like all these machines, but I mean, all of them are getting closer and closer, especially the replicator is something that you literally could invest to have in your house to do stuff with. Especially if you could get to the point where you've got home scanning and home 3D scanning and then home 3D rendering. Right. You know, you break something, but you can sort of like set it back into the scanner so that it doesn't look broken. Scan it, clean it up, and print out your copy.
Right.
And then they write the SOPA legislation that doesn't let you do that anymore. And yeah,
right.
How much is the MakerBot?
It's like $1,800 bucks.
Okay.
Pre-orders for 2,000.
Okay,
2,000. Yeah,
and that's assembled compared to, you know.
Yeah. Right, because they want to make sure that.
And it ships in only 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Nice.
I bet you those ship times are going to go up.
Yeah, but multiple colors and materials. I mean, that's sweet. Yeah, they won the Emerging Tech Award for Best of CES. Ooh.
Yeah.
Did you hear about Simple TV? Simple.tv. It's a DVR. But it's like a simple DVR. It doesn't come with a built-in hard drive or video output. It basically, it's essentially just one piece of hardware, and you can connect it to your own hard drive. And it will then stream it to iPad, Roku, Boxy, Google TV, and then you can also do it like Slingbox style outside your home network if you sign up. They have like, if it's like $5 a month. Yeah. Service to do that. So, I mean, that's huge potentially for cable cutter.
More and more disruption of television media, and we are totally in this transition now where, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, if you had bought like the original Apple TV or, you know, Logitech was putting out weird boxes, Western Digital and D-Link were putting out weird home media boxes that were really only for the early adopters who understood how to even hook up home networks and have media servers and things like that. And every 6 months we're getting another step closer and another step closer. And you get stuff like the Boxy Box dongle. The Boxy Box has basically been pared down into a USB stick that you can plug into the back of your TV if it has a USB drive.
Mm-hmm.
And it does everything that the full size box does, and it's getting cooler and cooler all the time, for better or for worse too. I'll point out. I mean, you know, I remember when I was. When I was a kid, when we had, you know, three networks. And, you know, when there wasn't anything on, I actually had to go outdoors. It was terrible.
I understand that I saw a little demo of some of the stuff that they were doing, this company, PrimeSense. They're the company that made the Kinect for Microsoft.
Okay.
So they've got their motion sensing. They're the motion sensing technology people.
Right.
So they're working on integrating it into all sorts of other things, like TVs, lamps.
Yeah.
Stereos.
So you could do something like you're in a room and you have a lamp and it's dark and you need to turn the lamp on. You could, like, I don't know, clap your hands
you could you could say lights on, for instance, or say, wave at the lamp potentially.
Mr. Data, illuminate the bridge. Beep. There it goes.
But I mean, that's just one of the examples they had. But it's the idea is that they could be putting it into all sorts of other things.
Right.
Well, there was one I saw. I was watching This Week in Tech, and they had these guys on, and they're trying to bring the eye tracking tools that they've done, you know, usually previously just for people with disabilities, trying to bring eye tracking to using your desktop or your laptop computer. So you'd have this little extra sensor bar that would be sitting in front of you. And it uses infrared to track the movement and position of where you're looking down to a very small control, so that now instead of using the mouse or a trackpad to move the cursor around and go to places, all you would do would be look at a place and tap. Look at a place, double tap. So I thought that was kind of interesting. It would take some getting
used. Can you do like some gestural stuff, like crossing your eyes?
Absolutely.
that would be really interesting, though.
That would sound cool. Huh. You know what was interesting? I was the same show. The AR drone guys, Parrot. First of all, there's like a 2.0 version of the Parrot drone, the AR drone, which is like supposedly ups it, you know, HD cameras, better flight control and stuff like that, which that thing rocks. That thing is so cool. What was the other thing they were doing? They were doing some amazing stuff with wireless and USB. And I'm trying to remember what, I don't remember what that one was. Headphones were a big deal all over the place this year. There was one company that were doing noise canceling headphones that actually had surface touch control on the sides.
I hear about that.
So flat side, and if you wanted to raise the volume, you just slide your finger up it. If you want to change something, if you you want to do forward song, reverse song, you just slide your finger forward or back on the surface of the headphone itself.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure that's necessarily a good thing.
Right.
You go to adjust your headphones because they're sliding down, and suddenly you've just, skipped three songs.
Right.
Right.
And, I like for things that I can't see, like things that are on my head, I like having tactile feedback. It's useful. It provides information.
Come on, move into the future, Matt. You can do it.
Well, I do remember hearing about one thing that I thought was kind of cool was it was an induction cooktop.
Mm-hmm.
That, because I've been using an induction stove, and it's great.
They're awesome, right? Aren't they? We've got
them. Yeah.
It's cool.
I love it, But you have to have your pot on certain areas.
Right.
And my stove, I don't know if yours does or not, but mine, it won't turn on if you're not covering enough of the area, right? It's like, oh, you don't have a pot there, I'm not going to turn on.
Right.
But then, you have like, well, I've got a large one here, a large one here, and two small ones in the back. If I'm just using a small pot, it has to be in the back of the stove. They've got this cooktop that was, I think it's, still like a prototype version, but you could put your pot anywhere on the stove, and this little touch screen or a little screen would show you where it detects a pot, and you could turn it on and say, here, I'm going to heat up this pot on that location. And then you can move the pot around and it would follow, it would basically say, here, wherever your pot is, that's where I'm going to direct the heat or direct the magnetic induction to heat up whatever's in your pot.
Oh, that's
so you cool. could, so you could, you have your entire surface, your entire cooking surface, you could put a pot anywhere. And you can rearrange as you need to. Oh, I need to move this up to the front. And then it would follow your cookware around.
Mm. That's kind of
cool. Which sounds really cool.
That's a good one. But, I like that.
It sounds expensive.
I can't imagine it's going to be. Yeah. It doesn't sound cheap. So, but as I said, that would be really neat.
Yeah, there's also the argument that anything, you know, that the more you jazz something up, the more things there are that can break.
Yes, yes.
And you know, cooktops are really, they don't need to be that super complex to just, yeah, you know, to work. You need them to heat things up. You want them to do that efficiently and, you know,
right,
you know, relatively safely. But apart from that, you don't really need that them to do that much.
Once again, Matt is the naysayer.
Well, I just, you know, the more complicated things you get, well, okay, then there's just that much more that can go wrong with it.
And you are, you are just Jeff Goldblum from Jurassic Park, aren't you?
No. I think that, you know, keeping things simple that should be simple, there's something to that. I think that, yes, things that you know, can have features added to them and that really adds something to them, then that's a great thing. I mean, I like, you know, I have an iPad. I really like, you know, all the cool apps that I can do stuff on, you know, that I can play with on it and play games and do productivity apps on it. And, you know, I certainly like having a, you know, game systems and such. And I like all the bells and whistles on them because, well, that's what they're there for, right? They're pieces of technology that are there to do cool things. Mm-hmm. Cooktops are there for cooking food.
Yeah.
And yeah,
they're there for facilitating the ease of cooking food.
Sure.
And you know, why should I have to actually get a pan on a specific little circle on a large surface? Why, I know. You know, what if I'm visually challenged? Have you ever thought of that?
Is a very, very practical reason for that is that I can no longer use a wok. I can't use a wok on my cooktop.
Yeah.
Because the small bottom surface,
yeah,
is too, you know, it's too small to go on the two larger rings close to me, and when I put it on the back, it runs into the back of the range.
Have you tried using like a distributor plate?
I've seen like some, you know, adapter plates for. I haven't seen any good cheap ones, right?
Oh,
ones,
okay, I don't have that kind of cooktop, so I've never looked at them, but I know that they have, like,
yeah, they do exist.
Basically plates that make a larger base,
right? And they usually come with a particular wok that goes with it, and yeah, they're really pricey, so I haven't bought it. It's been one of those, like, well, you know what, if I'm gonna make fried rice, I make it in a big, you know, stock pot now and just have a lot of, you know, stuck to the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, we have a sort of wok shaped big cooking pot that, I mean, but it has, you know, it works well on the stovetop. So I'm trying to remember where we got it. It might have been IKEA, but
maybe you need to start a Kickstarter project to
there build you go.
A wok.
Yeah.
The induction wok.
Yeah. That was some other, I guess some other news was the little article bashing Kickstarter.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I hadn't, virtually everybody loves Kickstarter, so when I saw an article that was critical of it, I had to send it out. But
I was like, what?
Yeah.
Just, right.
Well, what's kind of there.
It's a dissenting opinion.
It wasn't a very good article though.
The end result being is it wasn't, you know, even what it the content did not really match up with the title.
Yeah.
Shock. Wow. Let's see. The title causes lots of controversy and brings in readers, and the article itself doesn't really sort of follow.
It made a few good points, but yeah, overall, I thought that they didn't see as much benefit in Kickstarter as I think there is.
Right. I mean, they basically saw it as a glorified web hosting, which charges too much for web hosting. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, if it's just a web hosting site, sure.
No, I would say it's more like a sort of social media hosting site,
right,
geared to a specific niche audience.
Yeah.
And in that case, it's been highly successful. I mean,
yeah.
So you could argue.
That's true. I mean, but for every project, you know, we see a lot of the highlighted projects but and the things that other people have curated. But for there's got to be, you know, tons of projects that just never make it anywhere because they never get noticed by anybody. And and for them, it's obviously, you know, not doing so hot for them. So I mean, I see their point.
Would they do any better if they built their own site outside of Kickstarter? No.
No, they probably wouldn't. But on the other hand, they wouldn't do it. They probably wouldn't do any worse, and they wouldn't have to pay Kickstarter for the privilege.
Well, you don't have to pay Kickstarter if you don't make money.
Well, that's true. Good point. But
yeah, see, that's the thing.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I've not done it, so I don't. I've not done a Kickstarter project myself. I've only, you know, put money into them, so I don't really know. But I see some of their
Matt Morgan and I think Chuck Lawton have both done them and felt had a wonderful experience.
Apparently they did. Yeah, well, I mean,
Matt Forbeck, right.
Right. Yeah. Well, the one that Chuck and his wife did actually was one of the like the featured posts, you know, the featured project of the month or something.
Right.
And anything that gets to be the featured project is going to do well.
Right.
I mean, I think that's pretty.
But that usually means it's caught somebody's attention because it was smartly, you know, a good idea, smartly marketed, smartly presented. So
that's true. I can't speak to the specific merits of a lot of the points in the article because I've not done it. Yeah. But
similar to our good friends at Siege Toys,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Who so have they? But, you know, 10 times their money yet for the for the scallops yet?
Yeah,
I think they're only at 3 to 4.
He made the point that. That being on Kickstarter isn't what brings you supporters. Your supporters usually come from your pool of, you know, your network of people to begin with, which I think is true. I mean, that's, you know, you get other people if they are browsing on Kickstarter, you're going to get some random people, and if a project gets really hot, you know, you'll get supporters from that. Being on Kickstarter by itself, there's so many projects that it doesn't just mean being on Kickstarter instantly means you get recognition. However, being on Kickstarter means that people feel comfortable contributing to something based on the project and not based on, do I trust this person enough to put money into this site I've never heard of, right? And that's, I think, is the key. That's what Kickstarter is offering you.
Right. That's true. And using the model with Amazon payments definitely helps in that you know that, you know, if nobody else contributes to this project, then I don't pay anything.
Yeah.
I'm as I was talking about in our little email discussion about it earlier, I really think it's going to be interesting to see what happens because it's I think it's inevitable that at some point there's going to be a major brouhaha when some major project is going to turn it into a scam, basically. It's going to be, you know, they're going to make off with the money.
Have we all read the terms of service that we agreed to when we signed up seen what the indemnification is?
Well, I mean, the fact is that...
I always read all of it.
Okay.
Terms of service.
The fact is that those only cover them to a certain extent. I mean, that there is... that they can put anything they want to in there, but that isn't going to protect them from all the lawsuits.
Right.
So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. It's bound to happen. I think it can't be that every single person who has a project on Kickstarter is reputable. It's just, you know, there's so many of them that the odds are pretty good. Somewhere on there is somebody who's really just trying to make a buck and not actually give anybody back anything for it.
Right. But in order to do that, I think it is possible to do that. But at the same time, I think in order for you to be able to make to do that, I mean, you have to come up with something that's convincing enough that people will give you money, right? You have to have a good project idea, right? So
that is certainly
let's
true.
Say, you know, let's say like, you know, the Coffee Julie's guys, I mean, they made, you know, way, I don't even remember what their goal was, but it was, you know, ridiculously over their funding, right? And to the point where, you know, they moved in wherever, bought an old Oneida factory instead of, you know, outsourcing the production like they were planning to do. Right. You know, they could have done, I mean, they could have said, well, look at all this money. We'll just move off and keep it, right? But yeah. At the same time, the reason they got that money was they had designed a product that people were passionate about. And it was something that they wanted to make, right? And so, you know, in order to, like, I think it would be tricky to come up with a project that convincing that you
had. Yeah, that's the thing. If you have done a project and done the presentation of that project convincingly enough to an audience to get them to put all the money that you asked for into it,
aren't you going to make that project?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, yeah, obviously, yeah, you could argue that the con, but if you come up with a con that seems that good, I mean.
Well, I mean, I you could probably come up with something that, you know, that's just bogus, that you think is a great idea, right, or that you stole from somebody else. You stole a great idea from somebody right. else, and you just, you know, you have no intention of actually doing it, and you right. just, you make something look cool, you know, and right. you make a prototype, you know, that looks good with it, but doesn't actually do anything, so just you can take pictures of it. And, you know, I'm not saying...
So when are you going to do it, Matt?
I agree it's not easy. That it wouldn't be right. easy to do it, but which is why I don't think it's going to happen a lot, but I think it's bound to happen at some point. Maybe that's why it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
But I think it's bound to happen.
That's why almost none of the music projects seem to succeed.
Mm. You know what? Actually, I mean, music and film are the two biggest categories. That was it. They did a little YouTube Kickstarter. The two biggest total amounts pledged.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, there may be there's an overwhelming number of music projects, so I don't know what the percentage that succeeds are, you know, but as far as like the amounts pledged, the breakdown, it's still a whole lot of music, a whole lot of film, some writing, you know, like basically the arts related projects are still the biggest bulk of successful funding. And that, I think it goes back to Kickstarter roots were from, you know, indie music type stuff.
Right.
But
I remember hearing that. Yeah.
Yeah, but other stuff is gaining. I mean, other stuff is, you know, I think I noticed board games had a huge increase in number of supporters for people, mm-hmm. number of people who supported board game projects in 2010 compared to 2011. You know, it went up like 730%. So, you know, people are like, "Ooh, this is a good place to fund board games." But right. there's still, well, I mean,
Kickstarter
much
in general. I mean, Kickstarter. Yeah. The population of people using Kickstarter in general went up by a huge amount between 2010 yeah. and 2011.
Yeah.
So I think that's symptomatic of that. But I think you probably. I mean, I'm guessing here, but that you see a lot of music projects because, you know, there's so many people, you know, want to, you know, to make their own music, but mm-hmm. just don't have the money to actually produce anything but, you know, MP3s online. And, right. And so I can see why that would be, you know, an attractive project. Plus it's not that expensive. Right. I mean,
right.
I can see like you could put in, most of the music projects I've seen, you don't have to put in a lot of money to get something back. Like you can yeah. put in like $10 and get something, you know, you can get like, a, you know, maybe even a CD back from that. And, whereas in, you know, some of the big gadget projects, you have to put in something like $50-$60 before you get
yeah.
anything back.
Yeah.
Other than just your name mentioned on the website or something like that, you know?
So. Yeah.
Well, all we can say is that we love Kickstarter.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's great yeah. stuff. Yeah. I've gotten some really cool stuff off of it.
Anyone who hates it is bad and evil and wrong. So.
Exactly.
So, moving on. So let's do some posts of the week.
All right.
Since we've been blabbing on long enough, Jonathan, why don't you go first?
Oh, I'm the only one that didn't put one in the email, huh? I was ready to talk about Matt's post too about Beauty and the Beast.
That's fine. We can both talk about it.
Linked to the other post about Disney and Miyazaki.
Okay, why don't we talk about both of them then? Let's go. Cool.
Yeah. But we actually, you know, I saw your post and actually yesterday when our, you know, kids were out and we said, well, you know, we had some other plans fall through, so we decided to go ahead and take them to see Beauty and the Beast. And so that was a lot of fun. It was one that, you know, my wife really, really liked before and was excited about taking her girls to go see this. And I think like you, I could have done without the 3D. I feel like the 3D on the 2D drawn animation just looks weird. A lot of the faces are hard to do.
Yeah, I think that they definitely scaled it back, I think, from what they did in Lion King. I don't know. Lion King 3D. But I'd seen a preview of that also. And in that, I thought it was more intrusive where, you know, really it annoyed me a lot more than it did in this one. This one, I could pretty much ignore it most of the time. And I only really noticed it in the scenes where I actually thought it helped, like in the ballroom scene where I thought, you know, it took an already gorgeous scene and did actually make it
right
even cooler. I'm sorry if I interrupted you. So
yeah, no, but I think it was interesting thing though that, you know, for us, my wife and I both remember seeing that scene for the first time, you know, when we were, I guess, you know, high school, like, probably when it came out, and being blown away by this ballroom scene and the, you know, that mix of CG and cell animation that they've got there. And for our kids though, you know, even though it was like, ooh, it's a ballroom scene, like they don't realize that that was something new, right? That there was something interesting or that it's something that even stands out to them. Because, like, you know, they've grown up watching, you know, Incredibles and Cars, and it's like, oh yeah, well, things should look, you know, real and solid. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't really hit them the same way, you know, which I thought was pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that makes sense. Yeah. For those of us who, you know, who saw a lot of movies before 1991 and then some of the movies after that. It's true. But I thought it's such a great movie that it's just nice to see it on the big screen again, because I hadn't seen it on the big screen since 1991. Yeah. So it's a long time. And it's nice on home video and all. It's still such a great film. It's nice to see it on the big screen. And I liked the Tangled short too. I thought that was pretty darn funny. Did you like that?
That was really funny.
That's funny. Now, if I gotta see that, I'm gonna be blown away because one thing that I'm doing right now is am I doing that right? No, never mind. It was a stupid comment. I was getting two people mixed up. I was mixing up René Auberjonois with David Ogden Stiers.
Yeah, because David Ogden Stiers does Cogsworth, yeah.
Right. I'm working my way through DS9 on Netflix.
Well, so you can work your way through MASH.
Right. That would be bad, too. I had forgotten how good DS9 started in its first season.
Oh, yeah.
It really, really hit the ground running.
But they had some. I mean, they had some really great actors on there. They also had some not so great actors.
Right.
Nana Visitor was never such a great actor, in my opinion.
But I liked her in the character.
I don't know. She never really struck me. I mean, she wasn't terrible, but she had only, like, in my opinion, like basically two modes of acting.
Yeah.
And that was it.
But actually, I always had a harder time with the Doctor. I just thought he was too bombastic for his own for reality.
Well, yeah, I think that's actually just the way it was written.
Oh yeah, no, I don't doubt that.
Yeah, because I saw him in, what other role was it in some movie, Syriana, I think it might have been. I think he was
probably. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was actually pretty good there. I mean, it's, I think he's actually a decent actor. I just think the part was not written all that well.
Yeah, it was interesting. He came in as sort of not necessarily a bad guy, but an annoying guy in the English series Primeval.
Oh, did he?
And he was, yeah, he was perfectly fine. He was good in that, you know. Definitely had weathered and aged a bit, but still still could pull off that suave thing.
Haven't we all?
No, not at all. What are you talking about? All right. So you guys have done yours. My post of the week, I was
going actually we didn't touch on the Miyazaki thing, but
I talked to Eric's a friend of mine, so I had seen his Miyazaki piece before he submitted it, so I could proof it for him a little bit, and I think having daughters, I do worry about the Disney industrial princess complex, whatever he calls it. I do worry about that. But then when I watched Beauty and the Beast again, though, I was like, you know what? I don't feel like his characterization of the of this relationship is accurate, because that's exactly I thought he mentions the you put on the show a little cleavage, put on a dress in the ballroom, and you change the guy. And I was like, actually, no, that was the culmination.
Yeah, that's not what it's. Exactly. That's not how she wins him over.
Right.
She wins him over by sticking up for her father, by doing, she takes her father's place. I mean, that's the first thing she does, is he realizes that she truly loves her father and that she would do anything for him. And he didn't realize that people actually felt that way, because he's never had that kind of relationship with anybody. So that's really how it first starts, is when she does that. And then he sees how brave she is.
Yeah, and I think it was also for me, like, I was, because I had actually read his article before going to see the movie, I was paying attention to him too, the Beast. I mean, I felt like, his transformation is also not just about like, oh, okay, I'm, she's changing me so that I like her she likes me, but that he is actually working on, what do? How do I become a person that, that someone can see past this exterior. I was like, yeah, if you wanted to go for like the, for traditional, the rest of the Disney type princess that he's talking about there, she would have ended up with Gaston.
That's true.
Changing him into some, marryable, guy, and she would end up with him.
Yeah. Changing him to basically not be a jerk. Yeah.
Right. Which is Tangled.
Right. Oh, it's completely. I think you're totally right. Yeah, because the Beast realizes that, this is somebody that he really does care about, and that, he recognizes what's disturbing her about him. Hmm. And figures out how to change. I mean, with the help of, his various, talking objects that, his enchanted footmen and such. But you really see the culmination of that, I think, when he realizes that he is in love with her, and that because of that, he has to let her go.
Right. Yeah.
And help her father. He has to say, go help your father. And then, of course, he watches her and goes and saves her life. But still, that's the big moment where he realizes, this is what I need to do.
Yeah.
No, I totally agree. I was actually saying the same thing to Ken about the article, that, but I liked most of it. I did disagree with his Beauty and the Beast characterization. That I really thought that was not the way it really was. That, and Belle is such a different character than a lot of the other princesses. Mulan accepted especially, but
yeah.
Where she's very smart. She's very self-sufficient. She falls in love with the Beast, but she doesn't. And yeah, he saves her life, but she also saves, saves her father's life and such. I mean, she doesn't need him but she loves him anyway, but she doesn't need him to be a part of her life.
Right.
So, anyway.
Yeah.
So speaking of bashing Eric's opinions on highly successful posts. my actually, I gotta say, Eric, he's written two posts for us so far. Both of them been able to get promoted to the front page at Wired.com. Both of them have stirred controversy, which, and they've been fantastic. They've been very smart and well written, and make some, you know, make some choices, and that's fine. This is it's excellent discussion. He also wrote a post about why the Hobbit trailer creeped him out, so to speak.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he goes into a very strong discussion about how some of the choices that were made with the characters in the Lord of the Rings movies, that, you know, he didn't care so much about plot differences between the books and the movies, but he was disappointed by character changes. For example, he writes, in the book, Aragorn embodies nobility, confidence, and above all, the willingness to risk everything to achieve something great. He is a great leader, just the kind of leader we'd want to follow. In the movies, all his nobility is stripped away and he becomes just another angst-ridden man-child. I totally did not get that from the movies.
No, I thought that was a little much. I also didn't quite agree with his characterization of Eowyn, how he dealt with Eowyn.
Right. No, I totally saw him as being respectful of Eowyn and being very sensitive of what was going on, but never having... Actually, I mean, he had doubt about what he knew he had to get into and whether or not he was up to it in terms of the whole destiny that he was falling into. But when it came to Eowyn, I never sensed any doubt. It was, you know,
I
thought he acted entirely in a noble fashion with her. And, you know, I had actually thought that the way he was portrayed both via the script and via Viggo Mortensen's portrayal of him was, other than the fact that visually he looked too young in the movies for, you know, for marketing purposes, whatever, that was fine. You know, in the books, I think he's described as looking more like, you know, a really weathered, craggy 50s and 60s or something like that when he was actually literally in his 80s or 90s or something. But beyond that, no, I had actually thought that in the movies he was very well done. So accepting Eric's discussion from there moving forward, his point is that he believes that characters matter. And when it came to the Hobbit trailer for him, he wasn't so much worried about Galadriel showing up because... You know, that's an obvious place to go with respect to the appendices and the information that they're, you know, that we learned in the appendices to the Lord of the Rings that, you know, off to the right of what was going on in The Hobbit, there was stuff that would lead into the Lord of the Rings going on that was just not covered in that story.
Absolutely.
So, but his biggest concern is that the trailer shows what appears to be a moving, touching, emotional moment between Galadriel and Gandalf. And, you know, assuming that is some sort of character moment where there's, you know, either some form of romance or emotional tenderness or whatever between them, and his worry that this really is out of character for what's basically a, you know, multi-millennia old elf and a demigod in human form.
Right.
Effectively, yes.
Right. You know, realistically, it is pointed out in the books that while Gandalf is basically a demigod in human form, that so much of what he would be as a demigod is muted by being in human form, that he would be, you know, subject to some of the effects. You know, obviously, once again, this scene never happens in any of the books.
Right.
Right.
So, but then Galadriel never appears in The Hobbit at all. So.
Exactly. But on the other hand, I actually buy this moment. I totally buy this one because she knows what he is and what and what the millennia crossing fate and duty that he's been saddled with. And as one living creature to another, being able to, you know, knowing that they are realistically on the same side for thousands of years, but walking different paths, I wouldn't have a problem with seeing this kind of moment visualized.
Yeah, I totally agree. And plus, I mean, if any actors can pull off a scene like that, it's, you know, it's Cate Blanchett and Ian McKellen.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, can you get, you don't, it doesn't get much better than that.
It's not like they're going to start smooching and, you know, don't tell Celeborn. Yeah.
God, no. No, I think you're totally right. I think if you look at the way, especially the way that they portrayed Gandalf in the trilogy, you know, the Lord of the Rings trilogy that was just out, that was out, you know, a number of years ago, where he's, you know, he jokes around with Frodo and
and he's a
pothead, other members of the Fellowship, and you know, and he, you know, when they're, even when they're in battle, he's, you know, he doesn't joke around a lot, but he still does, and he, you know, he has genuine human emotional moments. So I don't have a problem with him also having affection as one of those.
Right.
It seems only appropriate that he would. Yeah. But I can understand why Eric feels the way he does, but I just don't agree with him.
Apparently, I mean, I'm not as much of a you know, Lord of the Rings purist. You know, if you, when I saw the movies, I would not have been able to really name, you know, what things departed from the books very easily, because I haven't, you know, I haven't read the books.
You haven't read them at least 20 times?
No, I haven't. You know,
I'm so disappointed.
I told you, you know, I'm over here pretending to be a geek.
Go back to your little games. And
my wife, actually, when she saw the trailer, like, that was one of the first things she said, was like, oh, what was that thing with Gandalf and Galadriel? I was like, what? You know, I was distracted by the dwarves singing. So I know it bugged her, and then, you know, and then that was what Eric was mostly complaining about, was that little glimpse of it, because he liked the rest of the trailer.
Seriously, there's nothing, what in the rest of the trailer could he possibly object to? I mean, the dwarves look awesome.
They look awesome, but actually, you know what? They look nothing like the descriptions in the books.
That's not true.
I believe first of all, I think Thorin was supposed to be much older looking. And secondly, they all had cloaks and hats they all had colored cloaks with some measure of, you know, all of the cousins and the brothers all had the same colored cloaks on and things like that. It was all
the clothing, maybe not so much, but the makeup and I thought their appearances, the physical appearances regard.
Oh yeah, no, I'm totally there with that. I'm being facetious here. I love what they've done to visualize and to differentiate the dwarves.
Yeah, I'd say they had to give them different clothing, because seriously, there's 13 of them. It's pretty hard to keep track of them all.
Yeah,
and who could predict that a guy playing a dwarf will probably be an international sex symbol after this movie comes out?
Entirely possible.
It's going to be something. So, anyway.
Yeah, the guy playing Thorin, he has a good voice.
Really good voice, yeah. All of them do. It's the singing rocks.
Yeah. And I love Martin Freeman as...
he's just
fantastic. Yeah.
He was really the perfect choice. He's got,
you know, who would have thought that Bilbo is Arthur Dent? And yet it works.
And Watson,
Arthur Dent, and Bilbo. What, talk about, you know, a Greek triumvirate right there.
And he was on the British Office too.
Yep. So. Yep.
Andy's in Love Actually, although not in a family-friendly.
No, not at all in a family-friendly.
Incidentally, speaking of Sherlock, they just announced that there's going to be a third series.
Yeah.
You know, so they've also said though, which I find somewhat disquieting, that there's going to be some sort of American version. They're going to have like a Sherlock Holmes in modern day New York. This I do not like, but
cause, well, I mean, he visits New York.
No. It's
like, you mean like an American version of the show?
Make a version of it.
It's been that will probably not.
I have a feeling it's going to suck.
Do we have? I don't know, House and a half dozen other extremely smart detective. Anyway, yeah.
I understand there is actually a nod to House in the Hound of the Baskervilles episode of the season of Sherlock.
Oh no!
Yeah, I can give it away. I guess I think it'll still be funny.
Spoilers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the Hound of the Baskervilles. You know the story. You know, presumably, you don't know the story.
Hold on, I didn't say that right though. I'm sorry. Let me put it in the proper professorial time. Spoilers.
Anyway, as I understand it from what I saw online, that he I didn't see an actual clip or anything, but you know, Holmes is talking about, you know, whether it was the dog who did, you know, committed the crime, and it refers to it as, you know, canis lupus familiaris, which is, you know, and he says, but it's never lupus.
I will look forward to that. That's excellent.
Yes, I love that they have a shout back to
That's fantastic. For what it's worth, for fans of the show, they did announce that Sanctuary, the fourth season, has been upped from 13 to 20 episodes. For those geek fans that watch it, it's a good show. But a different realm. So anyway. All right, guys. Well, I think we ought to sum this one up. We've actually talked ourselves quite long here.
Yeah, we did, actually.
It's been excellent. So, Jonathan, anything coming up soon?
I'm reading some young adult dystopian novels to see how the world's going to end. So, I'll report back on that soon.
Well done. Well done.
Hunger Games.
Well, that's already been written up, though. So, it's the main reason I have a copy sitting here. It's the main reason I haven't started that one yet is because. Mm. That one has been reviewed already, yeah. And so I'm reading all the ones that haven't. Okay. But we'll see. Yeah.
Makes sense. Matt, you got anything brewing?
I got a couple of things I'm working on, but I'm not sure when each of them is actually going to be ready to go. So.
Oh, I understand. There's always something to get done. Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything. I'm already starting plans for Maker Faire. In fact, we're scrambling. We've got to pay for ourselves this year. So I'm working up trying to get sponsors for Maker Faire, and let's see. I'm going to be at the Dad 2.0 conference in Austin in March, the couple of days before the start of South by Southwest, and I may actually get to participate in a Google panel. At the start of South by Southwest, which is awesome.
Sure.
And then I will...
Will there be personalized lectures?
I have no idea. And then in April, I will be out your way, Matt, for the USA Science and Engineering Festival.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Which should be totally cool. Yeah, that's enough that's in the offing right now. Otherwise, this has been the Geek Dads, episode number 107. I'm Ken Denmead, editor and publisher of Geek Dad. I want to thank Mr. Jonathan Liu. Thank you so much, as always, Jonathan.
Thanks, dude. It's been a lot of fun.
It's always good to chat, and thank you, Matt.
You're welcome, and as always, thank you for hosting.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys, and thanks to everybody for listening, especially Benjamin, our... I don't know what we did wrong, but Benjamin was the only one who came for the chat room tonight. So thank you for hanging out with us, Benjamin. We will be back in 2 weeks. Next week is the Hip Tracks. And until then, take care, and we'll see you next time. So long.
So long, everybody.
Hey.
Geek Dad.